U.S. v. Isabella, 17-1197.
May it please the Court, my name is Ron Gaynor. I represent the appellant, Rand Isabella. I was also the lead trial lawyer on the case. Your Honors, despite the fact that there was a split verdict in this case, where there was two counts of acquittals and two counts of convictions, it is the contention of the appellant that the government, in gaining its convictions in counts one and two, argued a case that lowered the bar dangerously and dramatically shifted what the real proof was that was presented to the grand jury initially. And we know from the briefs and we know from the testimony that initially there was a case of coercion against SF and the alleged production of multiple images of child pornography. That did not turn out to be the case, because SF in trial said, I was not coerced, I was not persuaded, I did what I did of my own free will. There was one image that was presented as child pornography, and it was not child pornography under the DOS criteria. What the government was seeking to do, and what they were able to do with this jury and this split verdict, was to ask for a conviction based on the asking of images. And as the court knows from reading these briefs, there is a difference between asking and persuasion and enticement. The government is seeking, through your affirmation in this case, to criminalize sexually explicit talk and the asking of images, and saying that in addition, that they were able to do it and asking for your affirmation based on the mischaracterization of a single image, which we call the torso picture, and the use of highly inflammatory and dissimilar 404B information, namely the testimony of ME, that was used to sway and inflame the jury. So this analysis today is not only insufficient evidence, but how that void was filled by the use of evidence that should have been excluded and was not.
Let me ask you, enticing is asking in a persuasive way, right? Or what do you think enticing is?
Enticing, according to the definition that was included in the reply brief, goes way beyond asking, and courts throughout this jurisdiction, throughout the country, have said that there is a difference between asking.
Okay, and what more is needed to make it enticing?
To make it enticing, you definitely have to go beyond asking. You have to sweeten the pot, so to speak. You have to overcome, in certain respects, free will. And I think enticing takes it out of the realm of denial of the particular individual, and they're so loaded up with incentives that they are enticed to do so. I agree. There's a lot of ways that this statute, 2422, talks about the ways the statute can be criminalized, but asking is not part of it. What we have, Your Honor, is an implication, if we go too far in this case by lowering the bar, of criminalizing sexualized conversations, which are purely under the purview and protection of the First Amendment. So we're implicating not only the First Amendment broadly, but we're also having enormous impact on what occurs over the Internet. Remember what Rand Isabella was in terms of the proof, especially with regard to the testimony of ME.
Did you make a First Amendment argument in district court?
We asked for a First Amendment instruction, which was partially given by Judge Arguello.
But you aren't challenging that instruction on appeal.
No, we're not, Your Honor.
I'm trying to see where there's any First Amendment issue in this appeal that you've actually preserved.
We haven't raised a First Amendment argument. We're just thinking that going beyond the fact and the current line in terms of all of the authority, by criminalizing and asking, you are going to, down the road, affect First Amendment.
All right, I understand your point.
So, beyond the First Amendment, we know that we have to deal with, and we have a little bit of an issue to overcome in terms of sufficiency. And we have to concede that up front, because what happens when the court and the jury come up with a split verdict. We can argue that maybe they were parsing through and making an intellectual determination of what is right and what was wrong in this case. But take a look at what is necessary for the completed act of 2422B. You need to have some type of authority that's going to show a completed act. Now, the government argues in dicta that that doesn't have to happen. But look at 2422. What are the cases that the government relies on? Faust, Berg, Lee, all the other cases. What do we have in those cases?
Well, could I just ask you a question? I understand that on count one that there were sort of these alternative convictions for a completed violation and an attempted violation. If the evidence is sufficient for the attempt violation, does the sufficiency issue on the completed violation really matter? I mean, count one would still be a count one conviction, wouldn't it?
Correct, Your Honor, because that's the way the statute is written. It's written either with a completed act or an attempt you're violating that statute. So I would have to agree with Your Honor. But again, we don't want to not look at this case in a vacuum. The reason why we believe the government got there was because of the introduction, not only of the ME testimony, but the mischaracterization of the torso pic. And just so we're clear, I'm the one who came up with the moniker of torso pic, and I just wanted to explain that briefly. This court, I'm sure, is very, very experienced in terms of determining, or at least seeing a record, what is child pornography and what is not child pornography using the DOS image, the DOS factors. In this case, the government alleges that a picture of a female that has been augmented, according to the testimony is of SF, and we can talk about that augmentation, a picture of a female without a face from just the neck to the knees, with legs close together, not focusing in on the genitalia, and no view of the genitalia whatsoever, a picture that was opined by an experienced medical doctor as being someone that could have been definitely over the age of consent, was used and held out in front of the jury as child pornography, receding from the original grand jury testimony that there were multiple images. And how was this image produced? It was produced by SF prior to Mr. Isabella asking for an image, whether it's a picture of a nude female or whatever. It was produced by SF prior to Mr. Isabella's request. It was produced under circumstances that she was doing with her boyfriend. All of this information was, in one way or another, brought before the district court, but we were also not allowed to cross-examine on the production of this photo, which was alleged by the prosecutor to be child pornography, when it wasn't, nor were we allowed to question the jury as to its circumstances of production, or at least question the witness with regard to that. So when we're looking at the sufficiency issue, we have to look at what was put in there that was inadmissible to begin with, aside from the 404B information, which, in our opinion, was outlandish because it went way beyond the allegations of what occurred with SF, included the allegations of an assault, included the allegations of travel, but was not charged in this case. And if you look at all the sufficiency cases that were promoted by the prosecutor in this case for a sufficiency argument of 2422, all of these cases were attempt cases. So I appreciate the question of the court with regard to how this law could have been violated, but there was insufficiency all around with regard to any of the methodologies that could have been used to prove a 2422.
Counsel, you've mentioned the ME evidence a few times now. And I was wondering if you could help me out on understanding something there. I take it that there was a pretrial determination as to whether it was coming in or not. Is that
it
correct?
Was challenged very, very aggressively to keep that out because of the inflammatory 403 effect.
And the court said it was coming in.
Yes.
At trial, you mentioned you were defense counsel, so there's some discussion about the ME testimony in the opening statement.
Yes, Your Honor.
And some questions to Mr. Isabella about it on direct. I guess I need some help in understanding that. Why wouldn't that open? Why does that keep the issue alive? Have you kind of let go of that by making reference to it?
Right, and one of the reasons why I wanted to announce that I was the trial lawyer to let you know that there was a boots on the ground decision after we decided to attack the admission of Emmy's testimony and did everything we could pre-trial to keep it out. What would be the effect of a trial lawyer's strategy if I did not address that up front after
right.
we knew it was going to come out?
Now, I understand you made a tactical decision, and I'm just wondering what the consequences of that are in terms of the law. Have you got a case that states that you can now on appeal continue to challenge
yes,
the admission given that you raised it?
Yes, Your Honor. I believe under the circumstances there would be no court that would want to bootstrap a trial lawyer's ability to fight a case once
No, I'm just looking for a case.
Yes, well, Your Honor, we don't have a case. We're just making an argument in terms of common sense that from a trial point of view, once we know it's going to come in, and remember, this was going to come in the government's case in chief. It was going to be mentioned
in
the case in chief.
Counsel, I understand your technical.
So, but I don't have a specific case.
Well,
but
sure. There's a Supreme Court decision, and I didn't realize this was an issue, in which the defendant wanted to bar cross-examination of the defendant on an issue. This is a case from the 50s or 60s, I think. I don't remember the name. And the judge said that the defendant can be cross-examined on this issue. So the defendant didn't testify and then appealed to the Supreme Court. And the Supreme Court said, sorry, to preserve that issue, you needed to testify and then challenge whether the cross-examination was correct. Mm. And so that suggests that the way to fight an adverse decision on a motion in limine is to force the government to do what it was going to do, not open the door to it.
Right, and then leave it that way and then have any presumption of correctness that would attach to the case by me not opening the door, and then having the effect of it coming out, which is much more serious evidence than what occurred with SF, and then blowing us out of the water completely.
But then you can appeal and say it shouldn't have come in and get a reversal on that ground.
We all know.
I'm not sure that this is that close in point, but it sounds like ordinarily that's the way you have to act if you were going to preserve the issue.
You know, Your Honor, I might.
You can't have it both ways. Minimizing it by mentioning it in opening, raising it yourself in testimony, and then challenging that it was permitted.
We knew it was going to come in one way or another. The government was going to put it in. They shifted from its case in chief to rebuttal. It was going to come in. If I wasn't the first person to do it, and this is not necessarily the basis of my experience as 33 years as a trial lawyer, but if I did not deal with it up front, there would have been no trust in that jury. Plus, we have the other interesting aspect, which is different from that potential Supreme Court case. There is a sufficiency of evidence issue based on the shifting of defense from what was given to the grand jury to what was given to the trial court. This was going to be a big piece of their evidence. If I did not deal with this explosive 404B up aggressively, I would have had no chance in the better level of, not the better, but the higher chance of winning at the trial court than up in the appellate court. Sure, it was a tactical decision, but it was part of the evidence that was going to be presented, and we had to deal with it.
Okay.
So I don't think
so. You made the absolutely right tactical decision for trial, but in the course of doing that, perhaps you forfeited the argument that you're making here.
Respectfully, I would disagree with Your Honor because...
Well, if you can find cases, that would be nice.
Well, we'll take a look, but the fact that our actions pre-trial were so extensive to keep it out, and the fact that the court has the ability and has the obligation for a sufficiency of evidence review to look at it de novo, look at the effect of the explosive testimony of ME, how far it went compared to the testimony of SF. It was a necessary component of trial, and a trial lawyer should never be punished for that.
Yeah, you can ask. If you don't notice that your time is up.
I have 13 seconds.
That's going up.
Oh, I see.
Yeah. By the way, if you can find a case, that would be helpful.
Yes, sir.
I've got to ask you, because I've been wrestling with your double jeopardy argument, if you could explain to me why these two statutes, 2422B and 2251A, have different elements for purposes of double jeopardy.
I think it's important, especially in this analytic, to not elevate substance over form, form over substance in this case. So 2422 has the elements, aside from age and aside from intent, to either, let's say, entice or persuade someone to do some prohibited sexual activity. 2251 is that prohibited physical, that prohibited sexual activity is production of child porn. The jury found specifically on a special verdict form that the activity in 2422 was the production of child porn. So it's very clear that the behavior in 2251 was the basis for 2422.
Okay, just a quick follow-up then. It seems that your argument would rely on the ability of courts facing a multiplicity challenge to consider the evidence in the context of the case at hand, as opposed to just comparing the statutes. Is that?
That's correct.
And what's the best support for that?
Well, there was mention in the brief of as to the fact that Blockberger has been modified, and that's contained in the papers. I can find that there's a modified approach where the court can actually look at what occurred under those circumstances in that courtroom, and surely...
Was it modified by another Supreme Court case?
I don't believe so, Your Honor, but we still have the fact that the jury clearly marked on that jury form that the prohibited sexual activity was the production of child porn, which is the element of the secondary charge. So what are we looking at? We're being told by the jury it's exactly that charge. That's why it is multiplicitous.
Thank you. Thank you, Counsel.
Thank you, Ron.
May it please the Court, Bishop Grewell, on behalf of the United States. I was only going to address the sufficiency and the double jeopardy, but since there's been a lot of discussion about ME, I'll briefly address
that. Could we just pick up where he left off
so on double jeopardy?
We can keep the same subject at hand? Would an attempt conviction, because I think what I want to do is compare the two attempt convictions, would an attempt conviction under 2251A, I guess 2251A and E, would that always be a violation as well of 2422B?
Could you say that one more time? Sorry.
Would a violation of 2251A always be a violation of 2422B if they're both attempt convictions?
No, Your Honor. So I think I can best give you an example and that I think will answer the question. So you could violate 2251 by telling a minor that you want them to go in a room and do some sexually explicit conduct. You want them to masturbate or something. That's not convincing them to do an illegal sex act by itself. But if you're going to have a camera on that and they don't know about it, you're violating 2251. Likewise, if you're going to try and convince them to have sex with you and you're an adult, you would be violating 2422, but if you're not intending to do it for a visual depiction, then you wouldn't be violating 2251.
All right. So in the context of this case, though, the special verdict form shows that the violation was production of child pornography. Both convictions were based on the same evidence, but aren't they also based on proving the same elements? In other words, why don't we, in the context of this case, have a multiplicity problem?
Because, as you were talking about earlier, so Blockberger is really kind of like a categorical approach, which we're familiar with. And DiCarlo, which I think is the case that counsel is referring to, does kind of take a modified categorical approach when you have alternative elements, not alternative means. Here, the underlying offense are means. They're not elements. And I think part of the way that we can tell that is, first of all, the focus, Congress's focus is on the changing of the child's mental state. It's not concerned with which illegal sex act you're convincing the child to commit, only that you're trying to convince them to commit one. If we're going to actually make the underlying offense the elements, which is what the Seventh Circuit did do in Manava, if this court follows Manava, then we're going to have a difficult time. But the reason the Sixth Circuit in Hart takes a different approach and the Eleventh Circuit in Jockish takes a different approach is if you're going to say the underlying offense is somehow an element, now the government's going to have to allege in the indictment, this is the specific underlying offense, put all those alternative elements in, which is a little weird that we want a jury to be unanimous about that when what the defendant could have any number of sexual acts that are in his mind. He doesn't have sexual statutes in his mind. He's not thinking, I want to get this kid to violate this particular statute. He's thinking, I want this kid to do this particular act. And so there could be three or four different statutes that it might violate, and we're kind of incorporating a specific intent component into the offense at that point, which doesn't make a lot of sense. Plus now we in our indictment say, okay, it's this one, and now at trial he's going to say, oh, no, I didn't intend to convince the child to do that illegal sex act. I wanted them to do this illegal sex act.
Well, just one follow-up, sure. And I know you've got a lot of other things you want to talk about. So DiCarlo, would that case pose a double jeopardy problem here? I know it's Sixth Circuit, not binding on us, but is that a good case for the appellant here?
It doesn't affect things here, and again, it's because DiCarlo was relying on a statute that had alternative elements, and it was saying, you've charged both these elements, and we're going to sort of see. So when you have alternative elements, you basically have two different crimes that happen to be in a separate statute, and it's kind of, that's why you sometimes see challenges on multiplicity grounds if you put them both in one count, because basically you're charging with several different crimes. And like with the modified categorical approach, then you can sort of do this Blockberger legal analysis, not a look at the case below, but a modified, let's look at the charging document to see which elements we're talking about. Because we're not dealing with elements, because we're dealing with means here, and another way you know that it's means is just seems unlikely that Congress in this one provision meant to lay out thousands of different crimes, which is what would be the case, you'd be all these different state crimes, versus they meant to lay out one crime with thousands of different means, it just doesn't make sense to follow that approach. And so I don't think DiCarlo is a problem for us because we don't have, it's not alternative elements in this particular situation, it's alternative means. DiCarlo doesn't say if you have alternative means that you go down that route. If you go down that route, you're saying this is a divisible statute with all the consequences that come with that. Let me briefly address the ME thing. The government also made a strategic decision and took a risk. We did not mention ME in our opening. We did not bring in ME in our case in chief. If after we had rested, they decided not to put on a case, ME would have never come in at any point. And so
what was the motion in limine about?
We got permission to bring in ME in our case in chief, but we didn't actually do so. And so it wouldn't have come in if he had not chosen to put on a defense. It only came in rebuttal. And at that point, one, he's opened the door. But two, at that point, it's impeachment evidence. And if you look at the Cerno decision from this court, it says that impeachment is legitimate 404. I don't think they've actually raised a 404 argument in their opening brief. They raise a 403 argument. In their reply brief, they say propensity in 404. But if you were going to consider that, it would be legitimate 404 at that point to impeach.
Assuming they'd opened the door.
But they had opened the door because ME never comes in. Take the opening statements and put that aside. Evidence of ME doesn't come in until the defendant testifies. Yeah,
no, I understand, but how would the defense know in advance that the government is not going to use the evidence?
By the time they choose to bring it in, they know we're not going to. Because
in your case in chief.
In our case in chief. And so if they rest, it never comes in. Yes, they had a strategic choice that they had to make as well, and they made that strategic choice. There were risks for both sides the way they chose to go with the ME evidence. But if you want to say because we get a ruling pretrial that we can get it in, you're also encouraging us to, anytime we think there could be an appellate issue with something, we might as well throw it in. We might as well not be a little bit more hesitant and decide to try to remove an error that could occur if you're going to say that there's no opening the door. You're encouraging us to put in every piece of evidence that we get permission to put in, and sometimes you might want us to pull back and say, well, maybe we don't need that. We don't need to create an issue. Moreover, with ME, besides it also being legitimate 404, the Leonard decision says that when you're talking about whether this is prejudicial, you can look at the fact that they acquitted. And the ME evidence really more went to the counts that were acquitted here. The jury chose not to take our theory that he was attempting to convince her to actually have a sex act with him at that hotel. That's really what this ME evidence went to, and they acquitted him on that. And so his notion that this inflamed the jury, I think the acquittal suggests that that was not the case, and even if you found it to be that the door was not open and that this was somehow erroneous 404 evidence, I think it would have been harmless. On the sufficiency of the evidence, whenever we're dealing with sufficiency of the evidence and we're dealing with it in the attempt realm, we have to keep in mind what the completed offense is that he's trying to attempt. And in this particular case, it's trying to alter a minor's mental state. And as the Fourth Circuit noted in Engel, when you're dealing with this particular provision that's trying to attempt to alter a mental state, it's not going to be the type of physical evidence you might have where when you're trying to do a completed crime of actually having sex with a minor. And so the evidence is going to be a little bit different. Specifically, we're looking to see, is there sufficient evidence that Isabella took a substantial step toward trying to convince SF to produce pornography of herself? There is sufficient evidence of that. He first develops this sexualized relationship with her through the numerous chats, which the court has. He then sends a picture of his penis to her. And then he repeatedly asks her to take and send him likewise pictures in return, similar pictures in return. And right after, she sends this so-called torso pic, which, to be clear, is a picture of her exposed chest and pubic area. That's when he says that he wants so nice and that he wants a somewhat naughty picture with her face. Based on that evidence, it's not unreasonable for a jury to conclude that Isabella was attempting to convince SF to produce pornography of herself. One other quick point. The defendant has talked a lot about produce as if the meaning of produce is create, and that certainly could be the case, and it doesn't pose a problem for our attempt, even if that's the meaning you choose. But produce can also mean providing to someone else, and if you look at the jury instructions in this case, volume 1, 584, that define producing, two of the words that it uses are issuing and publishing. That's more transferring something to someone. It's not the creation of a particular image. So we're not quite as restricted on what publishing means in this case. I've talked about the double jeopardy issues. I've talked about the sufficiency and the evidence. Are there further questions on any of the particular issues that you'd like me to address?
Well, I had a question about the testimony elicited from Agent Thomas. I know there was some dispute.
The grooming question?
The grooming question, yeah, yeah. Was the prosecution treating his testimony as expert evidence? Because in closing argument, it seemed like it was.
I think it got closer to the line. When it was brought in during trial, it was certainly just brought in as more to get this admission from the defendant that, because so the investigator is simply saying, talking about grooming, and the defendant says, yeah, I could see how you would see it that way. And so it was more for this colloquial use of grooming, that, you know, you're trying to bring this child along. At close, there was certainly a reference to the fact that he'd said grooming, but again, I don't think it was some magic word. There wasn't something in the instructions that says, if you find grooming, that is the substantial step you need. I know there's case law that talks about grooming, but again, I think there's both a colloquial and an expert sense here, and I think the way it was brought in was in the colloquial sense, And when you get to closing, it might be closer, but they certainly haven't raised, they didn't raise an objection to closing, and they haven't said that the closing argument itself was improper. They're just saying that the evidence shouldn't have been admitted in the first place.
I had one question on multiplicity. One difference between the two statutes is in the interstate element. One requires using an interstate means to entice someone. With respect to the child porn statute, it's producing something that's going to be transmitted in interstate. Mm-hmm. Does that difference in those two elements make any difference with respect to the argument defendant makes? If we treat the one statute as having multiple alternative elements, depending on which statute is to be violated, does it make any difference that the interstate element is different, or would the interstate element of the child porn production end up being an element of the enticement statute in any event? Assuming their theory is correct.
Right. I've certainly waived that argument to the extent it would be one that I could make. I guess I honestly haven't thought about that. I'd be happy to file a short letter on it if you'd like, Your Honor. But I haven't thought about that particular argument. I could imagine if the difficulty I guess I'm somewhat having is determining whether in practice there's a way that I could think of them being different, or whether it's just a difference in the terminology.
I'm not requesting a 28-J.
Okay. And one of the 11th Circuit opinion, we cited the 6th Circuit opinion, Hart, regarding why you should look at it not as the underlying offense, those not being elements. We didn't cite the 11th Circuit's Jockish opinion, but if you, it's related to Hart, you can find it via that route. Also on that point, in Faust and Thomas, when this court laid out the elements, it simply laid out the element as convincing them to do a sex act that would be illegal and suggested that was the element. There was no discussion of this underlying.
You know, as long as you've got
time,
I read the transcript on the, I guess it was the jury instructions conference, and the plan to do the specific verdict. Am I correct that at that point the lawyers and the judge were doing that in part in anticipation of this double jeopardy issue? Is that why the special verdict options were included?
Yeah, I would argue, yeah, we've got a circuit split on the issue. And so if we require unanimity on it, we don't have to worry. I'm going to finish the answer. If we've got a unanimity instruction, then we don't have to worry about some challenge saying that these are actually elements and you didn't prove the elements, and so it was a safety consideration, and it wasn't us suggesting that we agree that these are elements.
Because I at least had the impression the judge at that point, maybe it was a little earlier, was thinking there may be a multiplicity problem and then kind of backed off and said, well, we'll see.
Yeah.
Is that a fair interpretation?
Yeah, I think that's fair. And there's also some briefing when you get to the sentencing on it as well, where I think the judge then comes to this conclusion that they don't violate one another. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Do you have any time remaining? No. You didn't have any time remaining.
Oh, okay. Do I have a minute, Your Honor?
No? I'll give you 30 seconds.
Thank you, Your Honor. In the face of a shifting government theory from clear not beyond enticement, but coercion into this grooming theory, Howard in the 5th Circuit, Gladish in the 7th Circuit, Lee in the 11th Circuit all say that developing a relationship, having obscene speech, even sending an obscene photo, and asking for naked photos, that's not enough. That's not a substantial step, especially when SF herself says she wasn't enticed or persuaded.
Thank you, counsel. Case is submitted. Counsel excused. Court is adjourned.